our band this morning for leading us. It's got me pumped up for sure. Well, it's an honor to be with you this morning. As Jeff said, my name is Sam, and I am in charge of our sports and fitness ministry here at Grace. That was a great introduction, Jeff, wherever you are. Thank you for that. But it really, a lot of the credit and me being here this morning goes to my wife, as Ashley said. She is definitely the better half. This morning, you know, coming from a sports and fitness background, I know the importance of a warm-up before you get into a game or practice or competition, whatever it might be. But this morning, I want to kind of skip the warm-up and jump kind of right into our topic. This morning, we're going to be talking about David and Goliath. And the interesting thing about the story of David and Goliath is that many believers, but also non-believers, know the story, or at least some kind of detail of the story, right? I actually train, one of my personal training clients is a Hindu. And the other day, we were right over there, I said, Renu, do you know the story of David and Goliath? And she said, yes, I do. And we were actually able to talk about it a little bit, and I explained to her what I was going to be teaching on this week. I thought that was fascinating how many people know the story of David and Goliath. I think it's often overused and definitely misused outside the church. For example, we hear in sporting events all the time that there's a battle of David and Goliath, right? We hear a team that it might not have very good players, they might not have a very good coach, not have a good record, they've got bad colors, they come from a bad state or a bad mascot. I'm just going to pick a team off the top of my head, maybe like Michigan, right? And they're playing against another team that has bigger players, a better record, better coach, come from a better state. They've got better colors and a better mascot. And let's just, I don't know, top of my head, let's pick Ohio State, okay? Just for example. When both teams run out on the field, the announcer might say something like this. He might say, this is a classic battle of David and Goliath. But I think he has it all wrong. Right, you see, he refers to Michigan as David and Goliath as Ohio State. But I think it's the other way around. Because what people don't understand is that David was actually the stronger in the fight and Goliath the weaker. Because we know that David had God on his side, right? And so this morning, I want to kind of break down some of that and work through some of those misconceptions that people have of the story of David and Goliath. Now, and to bring it into the 21st century, I like to use real-life examples. And one thing you need to know about our staff here at Grace is that we like to have fun. And oftentimes, I am the brunt of many of the jokes and many of the pranks here at church. And so this morning, because I have the mic, I'm going to give it back a little bit. So we're going to talk about some of the Goliaths in the lives of our teaching pastor. So you know our lead pastor, Jeff, who's just up here. It's well chronicled that he struggles with hair loss, right? So that's his Goliath in his life. Our care pastor, Rick Newsom, played in the NFL, played for multiple teams, but his Goliath is he just couldn't hack it in the NFL, and so he became a pastor. You can actually buy that card on eBay for $8, which I think is a great investment, if you ask me. Our family ministries pastor, Jordan Damon, suffers from something we call small man syndrome. Jordan will often come to my office over here and ask me to work out with him, and he always thinks that he can do the same weight that I do and the same amount of reps that I do, and he just can't, right? So please pray for Jordan as he works through that Goliath in his life. Next we have Brad, and I call Brad GQ, because Brad's struggle is with style. He also thinks that he can play soccer like David Beckham, and neither are true, right? So please pray for Brad. Finally, last but not least, we have John. Sweet John, our student ministries pastor, struggles to be funny, and he's not, right? And John deserves this because John made a movie of me for the middle school in which my character's name was Meathead, and I spoke in nothing but a series of grunts, right? That was my role. Now, obviously, I like to kid around and pick on them a little bit, but I do think it's important that we visualize the Goliath in our life because I do think that each and every one of us have something in our life that we struggle with, something that maybe it's a trial in our life, right? We're humans after all. And so that's part of our DNA, part of our nature, is that we're gonna struggle with something. And so before we pray and begin our message this morning, I want you to take a look at this word cloud that I've put together that gives you some kind of idea of some of the things that we might struggle with. And maybe you see your Goliath on this screen this morning. I do think before we talk about the how and the why we must defeat Goliath, we first must know who we are fighting, right? What it is that we're fighting against. Maybe yours is not up on here, but I want you to visualize that in your mind because it's important that we know that before we dive in this morning. Okay, so will you guys pray with me as we start this morning? Dear Heavenly Father, we pray this morning that you not only reveal the Goliath in our life, because we know as human beings we are gonna struggle, we will face trial. God, but we pray that you give us the how and the why that we must defeat Goliath this morning. God, we love you and we trust in you that you will lead us out of this time of struggle. God, it's in your name we pray. Will you turn to 1 Samuel 17 this morning? That's where we're gonna pick up our story. 1 Samuel 17, we're gonna read verses 1 through 11. So follow along with me as I read, starting in verse 1. Verse 1 says this: "Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Soko and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle lines to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits in a span, or 9'9". He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels, or 125 pounds. His spear, or on his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and his iron point weighed 600 shekels, or 15 pounds. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Verse 8, Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, 'Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us.' Then the Philistine said, 'This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other.' On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and the Israelites were dismayed and terrified." Before we really talk about this story, I want to talk about the history of the Israelites and the Philistines, because I think it's important for us to understand what's going on at this time and why they are lined up for battle. You see, there is evidence that the Philistines and the Israelites had tension, that there was a relationship between these two people groups for over 400 years. We see evidence of the Philistines as far back as possibly Genesis 6, but definitely in Genesis 21, where Abraham is living in the land of the Philistines. We see mention of this in Exodus. As the Israelites are leaving slavery in Egypt, God redirects their path to avoid seeing the Philistine people, because he's afraid that if they see them, they will be scared and turn back to slavery in Egypt. In Judges, we see Samson freeing the Israelites from Philistine rule. Obviously, in 1 Samuel, we see David and Goliath. In Zechariah, we finally see that God judges the Philistines for the last time. Now, I'm a very visual learner, and so here's a map of the area that we're talking about. You can see the valley there in the middle and the five cities of the Philistine Confederation there off to the left. Now, off to the right, you have some important cities, obviously, in the Israelite nation. Now, King Saul believed that this was an important battle at this time, because he thought if they lost this battle at the Valley of Elah, that the Philistines would then move to his capital city in Hebron. And if they eventually got there, that they would conquer Saul and the Israelite nation. Now let's take a little bit more of a zoomed in view here of the valley where they believe the battle to have taken place, and where Saul's camp might have been, the Philistine camp with the creek running down the middle. And you can see there where the Philistines eventually fled, because you guys know the story where David kills Goliath and the Philistines run in fear. Now, this was a pivotal battle at this time, like I said, but I want you to imagine Goliath coming down out of the Philistine camp into that valley and taunting the nation of Israel for 40 days, right? So I hope this helps to build a little bit of context and a little bit of background as we dive into our story more this morning. Now, obviously, the story is not labeled the Battle of the Israelites and the Philistines. It's called the Battle of David and Goliath. And this morning, I want to talk about these two to help us better understand what is going on, because I think it's important that we understand what we're looking at here. So I'm going to invite my wife up, who's going to play David for us this morning. My wife obviously is not a teenage boy, but she is probably about the height that David was at the time, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. But I'm going to give her a few things here. Now, we know that David was a shepherd, and so I've got a staff for her here, and we've got some sandals, right? Here's another one for you. Good. All right. Give you your cloth here. Let's put this on your head. Get you in the full garb here. All right, perfect. We know that that David carried a sling. So here is your sling, David. And he had some stones with him. And we also know that he had a bag. So I'll give you the bag as well. Can you carry all that? Perfect. All right. Come on over here a little bit. So we know that David... Perfect. So we know that David was a shepherd and he carried a sling. Now, the thing about a sling is it's actually a very useful weapon. They could, a skilled sling thrower could throw a stone over 60 miles per hour and throw it 200 to 400 yards and hit a small target. Now, not only shepherds would carry these, but there is evidence that different armies would have contingencies of sling throwers in their military, as part of their military, right? We know that David also killed lion and bear. He was protecting his sheep. And we also know that David was somewhere probably between the ages of 14 and 18. You say, how do we know this? Well, David had seven older brothers, three of which were in the army at the time. Now, we know that Saul had a rule that you had to be 21 in order to fight in his army. And so that leaves four brothers, older than David, but younger than 21. Now, assuming that he had no twin brothers or brothers born to another woman, he would be somewhere in that 14 to 15-year-old range. Now, if he had some twin brothers or brothers born to another woman, he might be slightly older, 16, 17, 18 years old. Now, this morning, I'm going to play Goliath, right? And I do this because I'm much bigger than Ashley and uglier, so that helps you get a picture of Goliath. But it's interesting, when you study kind of Goliath's genealogy and where he might have come from, you see evidence, like I said, in Genesis 6, 1 Chronicles 20. We also see when Joshua and Caleb go and spy on the promised land, they see these gigantic warrior-like people. And there's some evidence that that's possibly where Goliath has come from, that lineage, right? We also know that he wore a bronze helmet and he had a breastplate that weighed 125 pounds. Now, I know I've got Ashley all dressed up here, but I don't really have anything that I'm going to wear. But I do have a deadlift bar here that is 125 pounds. And so to give you some kind of idea on the weight of his breastplate alone, right, this is 125 pounds. So that's about what he had on his chest, right? We know that he also carried a javelin and a sword and a spear, the head of that spear weighing 15 pounds. And so that was probably something like this bar here, right? Can you imagine trying to throw this, right? That was about the weight of his spear. We also know that Goliath came fully equipped with his own shield bearer. And I think it's interesting to talk about this guy for a second because he clearly didn't do his job, right? But how would you like to have that job? Here's a hunk of metal. Go stand in front of that guy and block everything that comes at him. Doesn't sound like a great job to me. And as soon as Goliath hits the ground, where's the shield bearer, right? I'm sure he knew whether the Israelites won or the Philistines won, he was dead either way. So he took off running for the hills. Now we see that Goliath was also 9'9". And there is some debate on this amongst people in different manuscripts and things. But I don't want to get caught up in the height because you can see just by the armor alone, he must have been a huge man. Now I'm 6'3". If I stand up here on this box here, I'm closer to 7 foot, not quite 7 foot tall. If I stand up here, I might be 8 feet tall or slightly under. But it's not until I grab this ladder and I step up on here without falling off, that now I am about 9'9" tall. So you've got David, a boy, with a piece of string and some stones. And you have me, 9'9", a trained warrior from a genealogy of warriors, right? Of warrior-like people, and all this armor and gear on. So I think it would be easy to conclude a victory for Goliath, don't you think? Just by looking at it from face value. But aren't you glad that God doesn't look at the physical, he looks at the heart? And we're gonna study that here in a second. But I think that's an important thing for us to understand. So thank you, Ashley, for being a great David this morning. Will you give her a round of applause? So like I said, let's look back at our text and we're gonna see some evidence of that God looks at the heart and not the physical. We're actually gonna jump back one chapter to 1 Samuel 16. I'm gonna read verse 1, then I'm gonna jump ahead a few verses to verse 7 through 13. 1 Samuel 16:1 says this, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king.'" Now let's jump down to verse 7. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" Right there we see what I was just talking about and a little bit of foreshadowing of what's to come. "Then Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, 'The Lord has not chosen this one either.' Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, 'Nor has the Lord chosen this one.' Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, 'The Lord has not chosen these.' So he asked Jesse, 'Are these all the sons you have?' 'There is still the youngest,' Jesse answered. 'He is tending the sheep.' Samuel said, 'Send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives.' So he sent for him and had him brought in. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, 'Rise and anoint him. This is the one.' So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Samuel then went to Ramah." Now, I don't know about you, but no one has ever come to my house and poured oil on my head and told me that I was going to be the next president of the United States. And if that's ever happened to you, please tell me because I think that's fascinating. Okay, but my argument this morning is in fact that we are all born to conquer, right? And you might say, well, how is that? David was special. David was chosen by God in this moment to be the king of Israel. Who am I? Right, and just like what I always say to the middle school students when I'm preaching to them is, don't just take my word for it. I want you to always look up and study it for yourself, right? So let's talk about a few verses here that give evidence and finally conclude that we are in fact born to conquer. I'm gonna read off a few verses here, so feel free to write down the reference if you would like. But it's a good study for you to do later. Genesis 1:27 tells us that we are made in the image of God, right? That's commonly known amongst people that go to church. We are made in the image of God. Now jump forward to John 16:33. Jesus says this, In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world. So the very person that we are made in the image of has overcome the world. Okay, great, that's making sense, I'm following. Let's look in Romans 8, where it tells us that we are predestined, called, justified, glorified, and that we are in fact more than conquerors. Great, okay, that makes sense, I get it. But the verse that I really wanna hang our hat on this morning is 1 John 5:4. 1 John 5:4 says this, "Everyone born of God overcomes the world." Everyone who has the belief of Jesus Christ in their heart, believes in Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior, overcomes the world. Now, to me, it doesn't get much clearer than that. You guys all know probably who Shaquille O'Neal is, or at least recognize the name. Shaquille O'Neal was one of the most dominant players in the history of professional basketball. Many of Shaquille's fellow teammates and even fellow competitors that were about the same size as Shaquille O'Neal said this about Shaq. They would say, "He's a bigger, faster, stronger, more dominant version of myself." And these are some of the greatest players of all time. Now, Shaq, from an early age, was born to conquer and born to dominate the game of basketball. And in case you don't believe me, here's a picture of Shaq in high school. I'll give you one guess as to who Shaquille O'Neal is. Right? So just like Shaquille O'Neal was born to dominate the game of basketball, we too are born with the power of the Holy Spirit inside of us to dominate this world. Let's look back at our text here this morning. We're going to jump back to chapter 17, and we're going to jump ahead to verse 32. Let me give you a little recap while you're doing that. Verse 32 is where we're going to be at. In the time that we've missed here, we know that Jesse, David's father, had sent David to the front lines to get a report on how the war was going and to bring his brothers some food. And while he's there talking to his brothers and other people in the army, he hears Goliath come down into the valley, and Goliath starts taunting the Israelite nation. Everybody is turning and running the other way, and David's like, hold up, what's going on? Why is nobody going and fighting that guy? He doesn't understand it. And so he goes to Saul and he asks Saul for permission to fight. So let's pick up in verse 32 in our story here this morning. David says to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. The uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, and put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag with his sling in hand and approached the Philistine. You see, David realized the situation that the army was in. It was truly a do or die situation, right? He recognized that he either had to defeat Goliath in his life or Goliath would defeat him. Let's keep reading a little bit further, picking up in verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy. Glowing with health and handsome, he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. Verse 48, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Now, like I said, we're all kind of in this do or die situation, much like David. And our second point this morning is that we are all born to conquer, and we must conquer in order to live, right? We must conquer in order to live. It is that do or die situation. One of my favorite movies of all time, is Shawshank Redemption. And in this movie, if you know, Andy Dufresne and Red are sitting outside in the prison courtyard, and they're talking to one another about what life would be like on the outside, what it would be like when they got out. And Andy turns to Red and he says this, I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living or get busy dying. You know, I love that quote, especially in relation to this story, because I don't know if David was a huge Shawshank Redemption fan or what, but I know that this quote was probably going through his head at this time. I can't help but think it was get busy living or get busy dying, right? Let me give you another example from my life. This is my wife and I in 2014. Skiing with two of her younger brothers in Virginia. Now, you need to know 2 things about me. I hate the cold, and I hate skiing, right? So let's rewind 14 years. I'm about 10 years old, and a friend of mine comes to me, and he says, hey, what do you think about going skiing? Let's go skiing. It would be fun, Reluctantly, I agreed, and it's not something that I'd ever done before. It was my first time going, and so my parents took me to the ski resort with my friend and dropped us off, and we went in. And if you've ever rented snowboard and ski equipment, you know that you have to take out a small loan in order to afford all the equipment. So at 10 years old, I mustered up all of my allowance and things, and I bought the equipment to rent for the day. And we go outside the clubhouse, and we start on this little gradual slope, learning how to ski, how to snowboard. Eventually, we get that down, and so he says, let's go to the bunny hill. So we do. We take the ski lift to the top, and we go down the bunny hill. And I'm having a good time. I'm enjoying it. I'm getting the hang of it. I'm learning how to control my speed and to carve and to just maintain my balance. And then he looks at me and he says, hey, man, let's go to something bigger and better. Now, I'm perfectly happy on the bunny hill at this time. But because I didn't want to be labeled a wuss, I said, okay, let's do it. So we hop on the ski lift, and we go up and up and up. And I'm not kidding. It felt like the heavens opened up before I saw the top of this mountain. Now, mind you, this is snow trails in Mansfield, Ohio. So it's probably nothing more than just a big hill. But to me, it seemed like a mountain. And we get to the top, and my friend says, we're going to do this hill called the Crossover. I'm thinking, okay, Crossover, cool name. That sounds good. Little did I know that this hill actually crosses over horizontally other hills running vertically. And so you are on a collision course with other people, right? So I'm like, okay, again, not wanting to be a wuss, I said, let's do it. So we head down the first part of the hill, and something amazing happens. My friend magically turns into Shaun White, and he's gone. I don't know where he went, but he's gone, and I'm left alone coming down this hill. I get to the crossover portion, and then these blurs going by me, right, in the kind of the opposite direction. I'm thinking, are those people? You know, I'm hoping that they can dodge me, because there's no way I'm getting out of the way. I get through the first part of the crossover, and I'm into this little wooded section that's kind of calm. I'm thinking, okay, I'm good. Next thing I know, there's this kid who's about a year or two younger than me, so he's probably 8 or 9. And the front of my board clips the back of his, and we both fall down. And no harm, no foul, right? None of us are hurt. We weren't going very fast. We just kind of crumpled up like wet noodles in the snow. And I'm thinking, okay, we'll just get up. I apologize. And next thing I know, there's this guy coming down the hill. And he's coming at me like Lindsey Vonn on the downhill course in the Olympics, right? He's spraying snow, and he gets up to me. And I'm thinking, good, he's here just to make sure that we're okay. He saw us fall down. That's fine. What a great guy. Little did I know that this guy was the boy's father, and that guy struggled with anger. And he starts yelling at me. And not only is he yelling, but he's cursing me out. He's telling me that he's going to report me to the snow patrol and that I'll never be allowed back at Snow Trails. And I'm thinking, hey, buddy, that's fine. This place is cursed. I'm not coming back. Don't you worry. He would not give up. And so he's laying into me at 10 years old, and I'm crying so hard that I literally cannot stand up. I'm sitting in the snow with my snowboard, and I'm scooting down the mountain like this. Right? 1 foot at a time, bawling my eyes out. I get to the bottom of the hill and I think I blacked out because I don't remember anything for the rest of that day. But I knew one thing for certain. I was never going skiing again. I wasn't going to do it, which is not going to happen. Fast forward 14 years, I'm engaged to Ashley, and I'm still kind of in this mode where I'm trying to impress her and impress her family, right? And they decided it would be a great idea for us to go skiing as a family. I'm thinking, you have got to be kidding me. 14 years of bliss, and then this happens, right? So I reluctantly, I said, I'm kind of left with two choices here. Either enter Satan's playground again and go skiing, or disappear and spark a statewide manhunt for my body. Right, those are the two options that I felt like I had. Reluctantly, I said, okay, I'll go. And the point of this story is that the only reason that I went was because I had a bigger purpose than myself, right? You see, if it was just me, there was no way I was putting on that equipment and getting back up on that hill. But because I wanted to impress Ashley and her family, I did it. Because David knew he had God on his side, he had a higher power and a bigger calling, he did it. I don't think he would have stepped up there just to see if he could hit him in the head with a stone, right? I don't think that's what he was doing. But I think that's it gives us a really good picture of what David was thinking at the time. Also, never invite me to go skiing. I don't want to go with you. So all of this sounds very good, but it doesn't answer the question of why we must defeat Goliath in our life. Let's look again at the text, 1 Samuel 17, 51 through 54. Verse 51, David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistine to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Shurim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. He put the Philistine's weapon in his own tent. You see, David didn't defeat Goliath for personal pride or for riches or for his brothers or for even for his country. He defeated Goliath for a bigger purpose. And that brings us to our final point this morning. Not only are we born to conquer, and we must conquer to live, we must live to win. And what I mean by this is that defeating Goliath in our life is good. And it's good for us, and it's good to restore a right relationship with Christ, to clear the way for that. But the ultimate win is the testimony that it gives to the army of people that are watching. Now, I think it's very important that we understand that the reason that David cut off Goliath's head, and I want you to imagine being one of the Israelite soldiers up on the hill, and you see this battle about to take place. You see David, 5'4" David with a piece of string and stone. You see 9'9" Goliath and all his armor running at one another. And I imagine that they were all kind of frozen on that hill with their hand over their eyes, but the crack in their hands. You kind of know how that is. You don't want to watch, but you have to watch. And they see all of a sudden Goliath goes down. And maybe they're not sure what happened. They're whispering, did Goliath just trip and fall? Did David actually hit him and knock him down? And then Goliath doesn't get up. And they're starting to think, well, is he unconscious? Or maybe they're thinking, is he faking? I don't know. And then he's down, and David climbs on top of Goliath with Goliath's sword and chops off David's head. And to remove all doubt from the Israelite soldiers up on the hill, David picks up Goliath's head, dripping blood and guts, and holds it up. Now, something amazing happens at that time. And I know it's kind of gruesome, but it is very, very important. A wave of courage shot through the people watching. The men, the warriors that once were frozen in fear are now ready to fight. We see them come down off the hill and chase the Philistines, leaving their dead on the roadside. They come back and they plunder their camp, and David takes back the head and Goliath's weapons back to his tent as a reminder of what God did. You know, and I think that's very important for us to think about this morning, because not only do I want to encourage you to defeat the Goliath in your life, like I said, because it's important for you and your relationship with Christ, but there are believers and non-believers who are looking at you to see how you will react when you have a Goliath, a trial, a circumstance in your life that is not favorable. John MacArthur says this in a sermon that he titled The Power of Unbelief. And it talks about the power of faith and the power of believing and how they're the strongest weapons that we can have in this fight against Satan. Here he's talking about different examples in the Bible of people that believed. And it says this, it says, David believed God and was enabled to slay Goliath. Martha believed God and her brother was raised from the dead. Abraham believed God and became the father of a great nation. A lame man believed God and was healed. A noble man believed God and his son was raised. The leper believed and was made whole. The centurion believed and his servant was made well. The people in Numbers 21 believed, looked at a brazen serpent and were healed of their disease. A father believed and his child was healed. Two blind men believed and were instantly able to see. Daniel believed God and the lions could not harm him. Israel believed God and walked across the Red Sea on dry land. The Philippian jailer believed God and was saved and his whole household. A sick woman believed, touched the hem of Christ's robe and was made whole. Naaman the leper believed and was healed of his leprosy. A palsied man believed, picked up his bed and walked away. Jairus believed God, and his daughter was raised from the dead. The children of Israel believed God, and the walls of Jericho fell flat. Peter believed the Lord and walked on water. Paul believed the Lord and was able to face his own death with joy. Three Hebrew young men believed God and stood in the midst of a flaming furnace unhurt. People believe God and are passed from death unto life. This is the power of believing. the power of faith. I think that's so important for us to realize how many times God comes through in the end. I'm going to invite the band back up this morning as I finish with a story of how Goliath has reared his ugly face in my family's life recently. This is a picture of my wife and one of her younger brothers, Hayden. And about, I guess, 7 or 8 months ago, we were on vacation in Nag's Head, and Hayden had some unexplained leg pain and swelling in his leg, and it got so bad that my father-in-law had to take him to the ER. The doctors ran a number of tests and found out that Hayden had a blood clot in his hip. And not only did he have a blood clot in his hip, but some of it had broken loose and gone to his lungs. Now, if any of you know, that's very dangerous and could have easily killed Hayden that day, but God saved him from that. Now, fast forward 6 months, they were able to get the blood clot removed and get him on blood thinners and give him a compression sock to wear. And he went in for his final blood test before the doctors were going to clear him. He was at home on Christmas break and was the last day or two before he was supposed to go back to school in Pennsylvania. And he went in to have this blood test. And the doctors noticed something different, something that was off, something they didn't like. I still remember the exact time and place where I was standing when Ashley called me to tell me the news, but I was actually standing right over there against the wall. I was doing some personal training, and when I got the call, I just had this feeling that the call wasn't going to be good. I don't know what it was, but it just told me this isn't good. I still remember hearing Ashley's voice come through the phone saying, all she said was Hayden has leukemia. And any of you know that have ever gotten a call like that, the sinking feeling that comes, the questions, the doubt, just the unknown is overwhelming. And, you know, it was really a devastating moment for me, being one of my brothers and a close friend of mine, to hear that he had leukemia. But there were two amazing things that happened within the first week and a half of finding out the news. The first thing, my wife and I, a couple days after hearing the news, we're sitting on the couch in our living room, and Ashley turns to me and she says something like this. You know, there's two options. If Hayden dies, he goes to heaven, he gets to see Jesus. But if he makes it, if he defeats cancer, then he's gonna have such a great testimony for everybody that he sees and interacts with. You know, and as a husband, I had been preparing for the sadness, for the anger, for the questions. I hadn't been preparing for hope and for joy, and it totally threw me. The second thing that happened was when we went to visit Hayden about a week later. We expected that when we walked into the room and saw him laying on the bed, hooked up to the machines, that it would be sad, right? That we would maybe cry together and pray together, and it just wouldn't be the same as it had always been before. So we get to the University of Virginia and we go up to the cancer floor, and as we're entering the door, we got a mask on, we washed our hands. There's Hayden on his bed, hooked up to the machines. One of his friends is sitting there beside him. And this is the part that shocked me. He's sitting there playing FIFA on an Xbox, slurping on a snow cone and joking with the nurses. You see, instantly, Hayden cut the tension like that. And other than him being hooked up to a machine, it was the same old Hayden that we had come to know and love, right? You see, that's the true win. Hayden realized that having that attitude was going to help him defeat his Goliath. And his Goliath, he knows, is not cancer. His Goliath is Satan. And Satan wants nothing more than to destroy his attitude and to destroy his testimony. You know, Hayden showed that David-like faith, and still does to this day as he's battling this. Now, I'm happy to report to you that he is feeling much better, and his tests have come back positive, and his body's responded to the chemo. But he still has about a 2.5 to 3 year journey to get through this, and it's going to be hard, and it's going to be tough, and he knows that. But he also knows that he has a great platform. You know, Hayden has not only encouraged and challenged me in my faith, whether I would have that same kind of faith in a similar or even lesser circumstance, because I don't know that I would. He's challenged my wife and her family and my family, Hayden's church, Hayden's buddies at school, at college, where he's not able to go back, have seen it. But I know this too, that non-believers will hear Hayden's story, will interact with him, and come to know Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Savior because of the testimony that he has, because he has already defeated Goliath. You see, the battle is already won. When Jesus came and died on the cross, he defeated death once and for all. Ladies and gentlemen, this always defeats this. The cross, 100% of the time, defeats any Goliath, any trial, any circumstance that we have. And so my encouragement to you this morning is to take your sling and your stone and lay them at the foot of the cross, because the war's already over. Jesus has come through victorious. And today I want to leave you with this. It is time for your giant to hit the ground. It is time for your giant to hit the ground. Will you stand and sing with us as we close?